Is Earth a laboratory created by higher forms of energy for the lower to advance through many stages of development? If so, these higher beings are our source but not the source. In Journey of Souls, I wrote about the possibility of a creator lacking full perfection and having the need to grow stronger by expressing its essence. However, it could have the need to do this even if it was perfect. The philosophy of a divine stair-stepping authority validates the belief of many people that Earth and our physical universe is far too chaotic to have been formed by ultimate perfection. In my view, this whole idea takes nothing away from a perfect source somewhere who set everything in motion for all souls eventually to become perfect. Our transformation from total ignorance to perfected knowledge involves a continual process of enlightenment by having faith that we can be better than we are. Processing council meetings, there comes that time during a hypnosis session when the subject tells me their council meeting is over and they are ready to leave the chamber and return to their soul group. It is a moment of intense reflection and together, we will evaluate the information received. Above all else, appearing in front of our spiritual council involves matters of accountability for the life just lived, and I want to use the relevant portions of this evaluation in my client's current life. Within the texture of any soul evaluation by one's council, there runs the thread of divine forgiveness. The elders provide a forum of both inquiry and compassion and display their desire to bolster the confidence of the soul for their future endeavors. One departing soul had this to say: "When the elders are finished with me, I feel they told me much more about what I did right than where I went wrong. The council knows I have had critical meetings with my guide about my performance. They don't patronize me, but one think part of their job is to raise my expectations. The council says they foresee great things from me." The last thing the elders said was to stop looking to others for self-validation. "When I leave them, one feel they have absorbed all my self-doubt and cleansed me." People ask me if souls feel remorse both during and after the council meeting if they were involved in acts of cruel wrongdoing. Of course they do, but often I must remind those who ask this question that accountability for wrongdoing frequently comes with the selection of the next body for the payment of karmic debts. Souls are directly involved with this selection process through their council because this is what they want for themselves. Although karma is associated with justice, its essence is not punitive but one of bringing balance to the sum of our deeds in all past lives. There is another follow-up question 1am asked about regarding the conclusion of these council meetings. Is it all sweetness and light for those souls who have not been involved with cruel acts, or do some souls come away unhappy with the general temper of the meeting? I answer these queries by explaining that I have had a few clients who left the council chamber a little unsettled. These are souls who feel they could have presented themselves a little better to a particular elder. There are other uncommon cases, especially with the young, rebellious souls, where I have had the impression they are fighting what they call an act of contrition by standing in front of the elders. The following quote is an example: "I get a little upset with the all-knowing ones. They lull you into complacency because they want you to spill your guts out to them. Sure, I made a lot of mistakes, but it's their fault in sending me to Earth in a body that got me into trouble. When I complain about Earth, they don't level with me completely. They are stingy with information. I tell them that life makes you take risks, and my director talks to me about moderation. I said to him, 'That's all very well for you to say sitting here safe and comfortable while I'm fighting to survive down in a war zone.' These immature souls do not realize that to be on a council, an elder has survived many war zones." By contrast, the next quote comes from an old, advanced soul nearing the completion of her incarnations on Earth. "As my session with the council comes to an end, the elders stand and close around me in a circle. Once in position, they raise their arms, outstretched like a giant bird, enfolding me with wings of unification. This is their accolade for a job well done." I don't believe I have ever had a client come away from visualizing themselves attending a council meeting without some sense of awe, penitence, and the need for atonement. They carry these sentiments back to their soul groups. For this reason, I was unprepared to learn about the law of silence. I will cite a case excerpt involving privacy of the mind, which extends not only to soul groups but also to my own questioning of clients about council meetings. There are aspects of council meetings that are out of the scope of current reality for my subjects. For a variety of personal and spiritual reasons, people are unable to recall all the details of these meetings. Some parts of this blockage can be deliberate on the part of the client. In case 45, the subject evidently knows what he wishes not to tell me. With other subjects, they don't know why they can't remember. Case 45, Dr. N, I now want to move forward to the most significant part of your discussion with the elder sitting to the right of the chairperson on your council. S, uneasy, I'm not comfortable with this. Dr. N, why? S, I don't want to break the law of silence. Dr. N, you mean with me? S, with anyone, including members of my group. Dr. N, don't group members exchange information on everything? S, not on everything, especially with very private and personal communication from the council. The law of silence is a way of testing us to see if we can hold the truths of that which is sacred. Dr. N, could you be more specific here? S, laughing at me, then I would be telling you. Dr. N, I don't want to violate anything you consider too sacred to discuss, but, after all, you came to see me for a reason. S, yes, and I have gained much. It is just that I don't wish to share with you all that I am now seeing in my mind. Dr. N, I respect that. However, I find it curious that you don't wish to share this with your soul companions. S, most of them have a different counsel than I do, but there is another reason. If we share all our knowledge, it can create havoc if that person is not ready for certain things. The profound may be improperly used, and thus by violating the law of silence we generate interference with another soul. Dr. N, I understand, but does this law also have to apply to our conversation about your growth and personal aspirations? S, smiling, you just don't give up, do you? Dr. N, if I was easily dissuaded from asking questions about life in the spirit world, I would know very little and would be less effective in helping people. S, sighs, I won't talk to you about certain sacred things which pertain to me. The larger implications of what this case had to say about mental privacy between souls in groups has been corroborated by others. It seems very odd to me that souls would not want to compare notes with their friends about all that happened to them in council meetings. Perhaps this is one reason why members of the same soul group are rarely given the same counsel. Here is another example of privacy. I don't discuss my panel with anyone other than two of my friends. Even the three of us are careful about discussing what transpired at our meetings. We talk in a general way, like, I know I need to do this or that because an elder said so-and-so about me. Considering that our life between lives is in a telepathic world, early in my research I wondered how souls could keep any thoughts hidden from each other. I found that young souls have great difficulty in masking thoughts from the more experienced souls, especially their guides. By level 3, mental telepathy becomes an art form, and this includes blockage for privacy. Without the emotional restrictions of the human body, such as shame, guilt and envy, there is no motivation for subterfuge. In a telepathic world, the paramount consideration between souls is their respect for personal privacy. Souls live in communities with intense group socialization where they work on their own lessons and those of others. They open their minds to each other to such an extent it seems impossible to conceal intent. This fosters complete openness on karmic matters which affect those souls who will be connecting on Earth. How are telepathic souls able to engage in selective mind screening and blockage? This is a process I know little about, but I have discovered a few details. From what I can gather, every soul has a distinctive mental vibrational pattern, like a fingerprint. The pattern is similar to a tightly woven basket with interlocking energy strands surrounding an individual core of character. The strands are motion pictures of thought where transference is voluntary to the soul. These involve ideas, concepts, meanings, symbols and personal distinctions particular to that soul. With experience, the soul has the ability to mask any picture frame at any moment. Thus, while nothing is hidden in a general way, no strand opens to the core to release a fine distinction of thought unless a soul wishes another to enter. Having said all this, I find it is usual for guides and elders to probe below a particular mental threshold of the less advanced souls. This is for the benefit of these souls. I know this sounds ominous. It would be, if all this was taking place on Earth. Our teachers also engage in selective mind screening toward souls who wish to mind probe them. This is because guides don't wish to burden the younger souls with concepts they are not yet ready for, particularly those involving the future. Everyone respects the sanctity and wisdom of their counsel. The information is considered privileged and very personal. Upon returning to their individual groups from these meetings, souls don't want their peers to be tempted to second-guess certain meanings derived from the elders. One client told me, it would be like cheating on an oral exam to tell my friends. They would be unable to resist their own interpretations of the meeting in order to help me. On the other side of the council table, the elders encourage silence because they know that if privacy is honored, this ensures greater openness with the souls who come before them. Undue interference by group peers later, however well-intentioned, might skew the elders' messages. The one exception I see to the laws of silence involves more advanced souls, training in specialized groups. They appear to enjoy sharing what they consider to be guild information from their council meetings. Since the spirit world has a timeless environment, one uses council meetings as a therapeutic springboard for rapid karmic reviews spanning centuries. Placing everything in the chamber on hold, I take my subjects back to key junctions of their past lives involving critical choices. I direct the hypnosis subject to pick moments in their past lives that are relevant to the topic under discussion by the elders. Many of our attitudes and ego hang-ups come from other lifetimes, and seeing this in a different context gives the client a new perspective in current time. Frequently, I feel the assistance of both my guide and the client's guide. Through this form of therapeutic intervention, my client and I look for clues to current behavior patterns. This will open the door to healthy reframing. Reincarnation therapy is more than cognitive understanding. People need to see that the twists and turns in their lives all have meaning and purpose. I may also move clients forward to the life selection room to discuss why the elders offered them their current bodies. If the soul is not yet supposed to know about aspects of the future in this life, it will be blocked. When I am finished, I take the elders out of suspended animation and the council meeting continues without missing a beat. I never forget I am only a temporary intermediary in the dynamics between my client, their guides and council elders. I know they are helping me because otherwise my subject would not be able to visualize the council meeting in trance. With the use of deep hypnosis, I have the advantage as a spiritual regressionist of utilizing both the soul mind and current human ego. The superconscious mind operates within an eternal framework which the subconscious is able to process into current reality. The importance of an awareness of our real inner self cannot be overemphasized for a productive life. I am not suggesting that the 1-3-HA spiritual regression session I offer is a quick fix for disturbed people. Nevertheless, a renewed conscious awareness of our true nature, knowing about our past lives, and our immortal life in the spirit world can provide a solid foundation for more conventional therapy later in a client's local area. On the other hand, a single spiritual regression for the mentally healthy client can do wonders for the recognition of their inner wholeness and purpose. Community dynamics, soulmates, between the first and second council meetings is a period of renewal for the soul. As ethereal beings, our growth actually began in the mental realm of the spirit world with other souls before any of us incarnated. So while our internal being is uniquely individual, a vital part of spiritual life between incarnations is devoted to empathetic relationships with other souls. Thus, our development as souls becomes a collective one. part of the expression of this collectivity is the association we have with these souls in a material reality, such as Earth. During reincarnation, the closeness souls feel for each other in a mental setting is severely tested by karmic challenges in our host bodies. This interruption of a blissful mental existence is one means by which spiritual masters expand our consciousness. I have listened to many intriguing past life love stories of soulmates who come across time and space to meet each other in life once again. Here are a few examples, where love was tormented, in a Stone Age culture by a lustful clan chief who took my client's mate on a regular basis and then gave her back. Where love was deprived, from a woman who was a slave in ancient Rome serving meals to the gladiators, one of whom she loved. This captured fighter told my client he would love her forever the night before he was killed in the arena. Where love was cruel, to a stable hand flogged to death in a castle dungeon during the Middle Ages by a nobleman who caught his daughter and my client in their secret meeting place. Where love was heroic, when a Polynesian bridegroom drowned after saving his mate of a few hours, my client, after their canoe was struck by a sudden storm 3 centuries ago. Where love was deadly, when my client, a German husband in 18th century Europe, stabbed his wife in a fit of jealous rage over her alleged affair. Falsely accused by local gossips, she died proclaiming her innocence, saying she loved only him. Where love was unforgiving, by a returning Civil War veteran whose lonely wife, my client, had married his brother a year after the veteran was officially declared dead. All the couples listed above are happily married to each other today. Their past trials in each life prepared them for the next and strengthened their bond as soulmates. Past life age regression produces interesting information about coupling, but placing these clients between their lives provides them with far more perspective on these relationships. There are many tests wrapped in the package of love. Mixed into those lives where we have had a long and happy life with a soulmate are those lives where we have destroyed the relationship or been devastated by the actions of our soulmate toward us. In the difficult lives with soulmates, something stood in the way of an acceptance of love. Being with soulmates can bring joy and pain, but we learn from both. Always, there are karmic reasons behind the serious events involving relationships in our lives. One had a client, called Valerie, who lived the life of a beautiful woman in China 2 centuries ago. In that life she rejected her primary soulmate, the man she most cared about, because he argued with her and refused to feed her vanity while others did so. Besides, Valerie told me in trance, he was so ungainly and raw-looking I was embarrassed to be seen with him because of what others might think. Out of pride, spite and feelings that I was being taken for granted, I married a handsome man who catered to my whims. I lost the happiness that could have been mine. In her next life, in 19th century America, Valerie was the daughter of a Cherokee Indian chief who ordered her to marry the son of another chief as part of a treaty arrangement. This man repulsed her physically and made her life miserable after she assented to her father's wishes. Their warrior she loved in her own tribe was the rejected soulmate in her China life. Upon returning to the spirit world after her death as an Indian woman, Valerie told me, "My love and I could have run away together." Aside from the great danger of this act, something inside told me I had to endure what my father had set in motion. I see now that it was a test. We have the capacity to severely hurt the person who loves us and also ourselves in the bargain. My life as a Cherokee woman was a reminder of my pride and vanity as a Chinese woman. Being with the wrong person for a period in your life does not mean that time was wasted. The relationship was probably intended in advance. In fact, you might see this soul again in the spirit world in a different light. This was true of the man my subject was forced to marry in her Indian life. His soul belonged to a neighboring group to Valerie's own. The soul of both men Valerie loved in her past 2 lives is again united with her in the 20th century as her husband. I should add that Linda, who is Valerie's best girlfriend today and a member of her own soul group, was the eventual mate of the warrior she loved in the Cherokee Indian life. After our session, Valerie grinned while telling me, Now I know why I have always been a little uneasy seeing Linda around my husband. Before one go further, it would be a good idea to consider some ramifications involved in the magical experience of meeting a soulmate. When I first sit down with a client and we establish a rapport, one will ask about prior and current relationships that have had significance in their life. In this way, I acquire a feel for the cast of characters who exist in the play of their current life. Since I am going to be sitting in the front row as this play unfolds during hypnosis, one want a theater program. Once in a deep trance state, many soul connections will become clear. People in my client's cast may be lovers, devoted friends and relatives, mentors or associates. Our relationships with people take many forms in life and usually involve souls from other groups as well as our own. Usually, clients have a strong desire to identify these soul connections in their current life, although most already have a good idea who they are. In a broad sense, love is endearment, which can take many forms in life. There is always a mental connection of one sort or another with a soulmate, regardless of the role they play. We connect with people on many levels for a multitude of karmic lessons in every life. When friendship catches fire, it turns to love, but without abiding friendship, deep love cannot thrive. This is quite different from infatuation, which exists on a superficial level where we have those nagging doubts about whether the connection has any real meaning. Without trust, intimacy suffers and love cannot grow. Love is the acceptance of all the imperfections of our partners. True love makes you better than you would be without that person in your life. People often equate love with happiness. Yet happiness is a state of mind that must develop within you and not be dependent upon someone else. The most healthy kind of love is one where you already feel good about yourself, and so extending your love to someone else is totally unselfish. Love takes hard work and continual maintenance. I have had numerous divorced subjects who learn that their first loves were primary soulmates. Things might have worked out if they both had tried harder. On the other hand, there may be reasons why we might not meet our primary soulmate until later in life. Soulmates will from time to time separate for a life or two and not appear at all. My soulmate and I were becoming too dependent upon each other. We needed to grow a while on our own is a statement I often hear when soulmates are apart. Every era on earth is different as to the sort of attachment and experience we will have with a soulmate. However, each life with them builds upon former lives. We learn valuable lessons from broken relationships. The important thing is to move on in life. Some clients may tell me before their session that true love seems to elude them. After the session, they usually understand the reasons behind this situation. If the right love for you does not come along, liberate yourself with the understanding that you may be here to learn other lessons. We mistakenly assume people who choose to live alone are lonely when actually they have rich lives that are calm, reflective and productive. Connecting with someone for whom you have no feelings just for the sake of not being alone is more lonely than being by yourself. As the song says, falling in love with love is falling for make-believe. This kind of love is a fantasy because it's driven by an addiction to have love at any price. If your soulmate is supposed to appear, they will come into your life, often when you least expect it. Over many years of exposure to souls in the spirit world, I have developed a means of classifying soulmates. One find the position of souls within one of three categories bears upon their relationship to us in the drama of life. Our guides and beings who come from spiritual areas far from our own arc not included in these three divisions. Primary soulmates, a primary, or principal soulmate is frequently in our life as a closely bonded partner. This partnership may be our spouse, brother or sister, a best friend, or occasionally a parent. No other soul is more important to us than a primary soulmate, and when my subjects describe lives with these souls as their mates, most will say their existence is enriched beyond measure. One of the greatest motivations for souls to incarnate is the opportunity for expression in physical form. This is certainly an attraction for primary soulmates. They may change genders from life to life together if they are more advanced souls. The average soul usually chooses one gender over another about 75% of the time. A primary soulmate should not be confused with the use of the term primary cluster group, where many souls interact with each other as companions. People use the term true soulmate to define their primary soulmate, which is fine as long as this does not imply that all other soul companions are something less than true. The disagreements people in my field have about such terms are often more symbolic than literal, but I take issue with another concept related to primary soulmates that bothers me. One have been questioned on road tours about how my descriptions about primary soulmates and statements of soul duality relate to the theory of twin souls. My answer is, they don't. I have discussed how we are able to divide our soul energy to live parallel lives, although most souls don't wish to accelerate learning in this way. Also, I have stated this capacity to divide allows us to leave part of our energy behind in the spirit world as an exact duplicate while we incarnate. Almost all souls engage in this practice, which represents soul duality. My findings of primary soulmate relationships and the capacity for souls to divide have no correlation with the twin soul or twin flame theory. My truths are mine alone, but to be blunt, I have never found a single piece of evidence in my research to support the concept of twin souls. As I understand the theory of twin souls, you and your twin were created at the same moment out of one energy egg and then separated, not to be reunited with your twin, your true soulmate, until the end of your respective karmic incarnations. I remember clients, such as Case 26, who said no two souls are alike at the moment of conception. Each energy particle is unique in its own right and created as a single entity. What is so illogical to me about the twin soul theory is, why would we have a primary soulmate with whom we could not work out our karmic lessons with before reaching a perfected state? Primary, or true, soulmates exist to help one another achieve goals. They are not twins of ourselves. Companion soulmates, our primary soulmate is our eternal partner, but we have other souls in our primary cluster group who can be called soulmates. Essentially, they are our soul companions. These souls have differences in character and a variety of talents which complement each other, as my case histories illustrate. Within this cluster group there is usually an inner circle of souls who are especially close to us, and they play important support roles in our lives and we do the same thing for them. This number varies, but the average client has from 3 to 5 souls in their inner circle. Although the companion souls in a cluster group started together, they do have different rates of development. This has as much to do with drive and motivation as talent. Each soul does possess certain strengths that their companions can draw upon during group incarnations. As the group gets smaller, many go off into different specializations, but they do not lose contact with each other. Affiliated souls. This classification of souls pertains to members of secondary groups outside our own primary cluster but located in the same general spiritual vicinity. As one mentioned in Chapter 5 under Figure 1, secondary groups around our own primary group can total up to 1,000 souls or more. Many of these groups work in classrooms near us. There are certain affiliated souls in other groups who are selected to work with us, whom we come to know over many lives, while others may only cross our path briefly. Quite often our parents come from one of these nearby cluster groups. In terms of social interaction in the spirit world, as well as contact during their physical incarnations, souls of one cluster group may have little or no association with many of the souls in a secondary group. In the larger context, all souls in a secondary group are affiliated in one way or another, but they are not considered soulmates by my clients. Although they are not really companion souls, they do form a large pool of people available for casting calls by our directors in the life to come. A soul affiliate might have a specific characteristic that is exactly what is needed to bring a karmic lesson into your life. They are very likely to incarnate as people who carry strong positive or negative energy into their association with you. These decisions depend upon advance agreements between all parties and their respective teachers as to the benefits and disadvantages of certain character roles. The role can be very brief. The reader may recall the bus stop incident related by the subject in case 39. The assistance given to the woman in that case was more likely spontaneous, and I feel this subject was a non-affiliated soul.